Our next presentation will be given by Dr. Mary Ellen Sanders. Dr. Sanders earned her PhD from North Carolina State University, and through her company, Dairy and Food Culture Technologies, is an internationally recognized consultant in the area of probiotic microbiology. She was the founding president of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, or ISAP, as some of you may recognize it, and remains that organization's executive director. Her work helps food and supplement companies develop new probiotic products. She provides technical support for enhancing existing probiotic product lines. Dr. Sanders also holds volunteer appointments as a visiting research scientist at the California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo and as a clinical instructor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Colorado here in Denver. Dr. Sanders.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you so much, Jeff, for the invitation to speak here today. And also, as a over 20-year resident of Colorado, I feel I need to welcome you all to the lovely state of Colorado, and I hope you're enjoying your time here. It's always fun to welcome colleagues and friends here and enjoy what I've just grown to love over the past 20 years. My task today is a little bit different from the previous speakers, and what I'm going to be looking at really is a regulatory framework and some issues that are going on regarding marketing these probiotic products. What I would like to say is that this really is going to be focused on human products. I'm not really going to be dwelling into claims made on animal products. And most of my examples really are in the probiotic area just because that's what I'm more familiar with. I will say that the regulatory issues regarding prebiotics, for the most part, the examples I'll give with probiotics are very consistent and applicable to what's going on with the prebiotic field. But there is one possible exception to that. In the field of prebiotics, the FDA really does view prebiotics more as a food. And with probiotics, because a probiotic is alive, the FDA has made the decision that a probiotic really should, instead of being fall under the jurisdiction of the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, or CIFSAN, which is one of the offices in the FDA, they're shunting probiotics, because they're live microorganisms, into the jurisdiction of CBER, which is a Center for Biologics Evaluation Research. And CBER also has jurisdiction over vaccines, for example. And so CBER really has a tendency to see things more as drugs than they do as foods, whereas CIFSAN sees things more often as foods rather than drugs. And even though within the United States regulatory structure, products should be regulated strictly on their intention of use, there does seem to be a bias that's developing within the regulatory structures within the U.S. that complicates things a little bit relative to probiotics and prebiotics. But with that as a caveat, I am going to focus more on the probiotic area as I go through this talk, but I do think for the most part these issues are fairly applicable. Well, when I was having my morning coffee a few weeks ago, I came across a comic that I thought was going to be all I had to present for today. And here it is. I thought that this pretty much summarized what people are going through here. And what we have is the manager coming in talking to the scientist, and the scientist looking at the board with data, and there's nothing there. And the conclusion is eating chocolate will make you look younger and thinner. And the manager says, look, half the work is done. All you need to do is fill in the top part so we can legally say the bottom part. And it would be nice if it were that easy, but of course it's much, much more complicated than that. And so what I'd like to try to focus on right now are some of the issues, and certainly anyone who's been reading any of the popular press information or the trade magazines is very aware that the issue of substantiation of claims is really front and center right now relative to the probiotic world. And I'm just going to run through a few examples of how these issues are raising their heads today. The Center for Science and the Public Interest, which is a consumer watchdog organization, recently published a document called Food Labeling Chaos. And one of the conclusions that they made in this document is that in the absence of effective regulation, structure function claims have become one of the most deceptive forms of claims on food labels today. You know, that's quite an indictment, I think. CSPI also a couple of years back did an expose on products containing probiotics, and they took it upon themselves to make judgments about whether or not different products that are on the market making claims had any validity and any science behind them, and they came to their, you know, different conclusions about the level of validity on that. Another issue that I'm sure all of you are aware of and has been mentioned already today is the issue of activity by the European Food Safety Authority. And the European Food Safety Authority, or EFSA, has been actively reviewing thousands of claims on food ingredients and their relationship to health. And unlike in the United States and Europe, in order to make any type of health benefit claim, be it a structure function type claim or a health claim, to put it in the vernacular of the United States, you have to have approval. And so within EFSA, the Nutrition, Dietetics, and Allergy Committee has the responsibility to review the probiotic and prebiotic claims. And essentially the situation today is that over 100 claims have been reviewed by the NDA, and all of these claims relative to probiotics and any health benefit have been denied. And so they have not approved a single relationship between a probiotic and a health claim in Europe. Now, most of these claims are denied for insufficient characterization of the product. There have been claims, however, rejected based on inadequate substantiation that the strains used in the published studies are equivalent to the strains that are in the product, and I think that's an important link that must be made. Claims are rejected based on wording of the claim, and this is a very interesting issue. So, for example, a dossier being reviewed by EFSA, what they'll do is they'll look at what you're asking, and an example was, and I forget the strain designation, but there was a lactobacillus strain that was submitted for approval for a claim for its effect on oral microbiology or oral flora. And what EFSA said is, well, just saying it has an impact on oral flora isn't clear enough. So what we're going to interpret that to mean is that this particular strain has an effect on reducing the levels of Streptococcus mutans, which is the causative agent of dental caries in the oral, within the oral flora. And then EFSA said, well, okay, or I should say the NDA said, well, okay, is reducing levels of strep mutans a health benefit? You know, if you could demonstrate that, would that be a health benefit? And they said, yes, that would be. They interpreted it in a positive way. But then they went back and looked at the data that were submitted within the dossier for this lactobacillus strain, and they said, well, there's no causality, that the data aren't strong enough to link the presence of this lactobacillus strain and the ability to reduce Streptococcus mutans in the oral cavity. But of course, the people submitting the dossier didn't actually submit it for that claim, but that's still the standard that they were evaluated under. So there's quite a bit of difficulty relative to submission of these dossiers. Oops, I'm sorry. And how the claims are worded. And then there were, I think, three dossiers that were reviewed then based on, that actually got to the point where they were, and this again is only for the probiotic literature or probiotic dossiers, that actually then were reviewed for whether or not they actually could demonstrate causality between the claimed health benefit and the presence of the probiotic, and they were all rejected. So that's the situation in Europe right now. Now in the United States, the FDA has made a few actions, although again in the United States we do not have approval for claims known as structure function claims that are statements relating the particular product, in this case a pro or prebiotic, to the normal structure and functioning of the human body. But what has happened in the U.S. is that, now these are just warning letters in general, is in there were 73 warning letters that the FDA issued in 2009 for food products in general and claims that were being made. 44 were issued in 2008, and this led Nutri Ingredients, this is a quote from them, to comment that this represents a 66% increase in the number of warning letters that the FDA is sending out, which they believe is a reflection of new leadership within the FDA that's now going to start cracking down more on claims that they feel are unsubstantiated. So that may be, more to come on that. Now, an example of one of those FDA warning letters is shown in this slide, and I think that there's a lot to be learned. If you have an interest in this area and you haven't read this letter, I would highly recommend doing it. It's a warning letter that went out to Nestle Healthcare Nutrition regarding their Boost Kit Essentials Nutritionally Complete Drink, which can be the active ingredient in that. Or one of the active ingredients is a probiotic. And the warning letter essentially tells them that they have a product that's misbranded, and the misbranding of that product, or mislabeled, I should say, is comprised of the fact that the product is promoted for conditions that cause it to be a drug. Excuse me, therapeutic claims on their website establish that this product is a drug because it is intended to cure for use in the cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease. And if you look at the information that the warning letter quotes from the website, is they refer back to the specific product and its use in chronic illnesses, its use in one of the most widely studied generic probiotics providing numerous health benefits across many illnesses. So these are definitely words you don't use in a structure function claim. And they're claiming that the product can help with diarrhea caused by antibiotics and some other similar types of claims like this. And as far as the FDA is concerned, that's a drug use. And so they said that this is not allowed. They gave Nestle, you know, basically called them to task and said, you need to get rid of this information on your website. Now, if you go on and read at the end of the letter, it even gets more interesting because the FDA also takes issue with what Nestle has on their website regarding this particular product. And it has to do with their citations of certain papers that, in FDA's opinion, essentially links the product to what they would consider a drug use. And so what Nestle did was that they cited several publications, and I'll just mention one of them here, Wiseman et al., which was a study that was conducted on the effect of a probiotic infant formula on the ability to prevent the incidence or duration or reduce the duration of infections in child care centers. And this particular endpoint, as far as the FDA is concerned, is a drug endpoint, and therefore the mere fact that Nestle refers to this paper on their website, essentially the FDA interpreted that as that the website was linked to the product and essentially could be considered a version of product labeling, and therefore by inference that if you have papers that speak to drug endpoints, you can't, you know, that's going to deem your product a drug as well. And so that was all part of the response that the FDA gave. So they basically said a citation of a publication or reference in the labeling of a product is considered to be a claim about disease treatment or prevention if the citation refers to disease use and if, in the context of labeling as a whole, the citation implies treatment or prevention of disease. And of course, the reason I think this is so significant is that, of course, you can see how more and more, even if you're a company or a researcher trying to do good science on understanding the relationship of probiotics or prebiotics on health and disease, you really are very limited in terms of how you can communicate any of that information to consumers or healthcare professionals. And another big area where this is front and center now is the existence of different types of lawsuits. This was an announcement that Danone was being sued for their claims. Danone, of course, the day later came out with a response to the lawsuit. But essentially what's happening in this particular case, and this case I believe is now settled, but basically there was a class action lawsuit that said that the claims that were being made on the products weren't substantiated. And so that's another example of the issue of health claims being front and center right now. And I think, you know, the evidence that these types of actions have an impact on how products are labeled in our market comes from the fact that Danone did, about a year and 9 months after the lawsuit was filed, did opt to remove the term immunity from their label from their DanActive product, which is a product that's sold based on its ability to enhance body's defenses. Now, also relative to the Danone case, I think is interesting is that, again, available in a press release that Danone released, they also commented that the FTC was scrutinizing their claims. And so sort of a side effect of some of this increased attention on claims has now brought the FTC to bear, and they are now evaluating whether or not the claims are substantiated and are truthful and not misleading. So I think the point I'm trying to make with all of this introduction is that there are lots of eyes that are carefully looking at the claims that you're making on your products, regulatory agencies, watchdog organizations, marketplace competitors, lawyers, the media, healthcare professionals, and consumers, and hopefully your claims are going to be able to measure up against what's coming to be greater and greater scrutiny. Now, the current situation in the United States, I've alluded to some of the issues, but the FDA, in fact, has never challenged a probiotic food or a dietary supplement for lack of evidence substantiating a properly worded structure function claim. So their objections with the Nestle example was with them saying that really this is not a properly worded structure function claim. You're trying to sell your product as an unapproved drug. But as long as you word something as a structure function claim, which again relates back to the normal structure and function of the human body, the FDA has yet to really call anyone to task for inadequate substantiation of those claims. And again, this next bullet point just refers to the importance of not presenting your product as a drug. But another subtlety that has come out of this whole issue in the stand of the FDA, where they have really what's a fairly rigid interpretation of what a drug is that their impact on research is also being felt. And so what is starting to happen is that if a researcher, an investigator goes to centers like this National Institutes of Health, one of the centers there of the NIH, and tries to get a grant to study probiotics, what ends up happening is that because this is government-funded research, the FDA gets involved at the time of funding the study. And what the FDA is saying is that not only can't you market a product that claims to be, in their opinion, that you're claiming to be a drug, but you can't do research that, in their opinion, would link this product to a drug, to drug research, unless what you can do is do what they're saying is, if you want to do drug, what they consider drug endpoint research, you have to get an investigational new drug application on file. And I think one of the subtleties here is that the FDA is not currently distinguishing between research that's designed to understand biological activity of important dietary ingredients such as pro and prebiotics and the ultimate intention of how you want to market that product. What they're doing is intervening at the research stage and saying you can't even do the study to evaluate that. And let me just take a couple of minutes to describe sort of the ultimate case, an example of what ends up happening when the FDA gets involved in this regard. Now, this was what we're seeing primarily, again, in the probiotic area is the action on the part of the Center for Biologics, CBER. And what's happening is they're saying if you try to do a study with a drug use endpoint, in their opinion, you need an investigational new drug application, which people aren't intending to market their products as drugs. And so this is a burden to have to go through this type of a filing. So an example is there is a researcher at Georgetown University who submitted a grant to the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Research and was funded for a study to look at the effect of a probiotic yogurt and its ability to decrease the incidence of antibiotic-associated diarrhea in children that were otherwise healthy but were getting antibiotics for things like ear infections. And what happened is the National Institutes of Health granted the money, and then CBER said, no, but in order to do this, you need a investigational new drug application to proceed, which, to make a very long story short, they ended up filing an IND, and then when it went back to this NIH, what the NIH then said is, well, now that you're doing a drug research, what we cannot approve as an initial study the effect of a probiotic yogurt, or the effect of, actually, I should say, effect of what they're viewing as a drug on efficacy. You have to start with safety studies. And so everyone's thinking, well, this yogurt is really just almost what you could buy commercially off the grocery store shelves today, but now NIH is requiring a safety study on that. And it's like, okay, but then they came back again and they said, well, if this is your first safety study, then it can't be in children because you never do a phase one study in children, so you have to do this study in adults. And so instead of putting the money into an efficacy study on the effect of this yogurt on antibiotic-associated side effects in children, there's $650,000 of American taxpayer money being used to do a safety study of what essentially is a commercial yogurt on 40 healthy adults that, according to the investigator, that these people are so healthy that it's hard to find them to be able to actually recruit them. And they're going to track whether or not these people on antibiotics have any safety associated difficulties. And so that's sort of the box that we're backed into, that if you say, okay, these are drugs, then you start treating them as drugs, and that ends up being a colossal waste of taxpayer money. And it's a project that really no investigator is even all that interested in doing that kind of research. So anyway, that's currently what's going on. Now, the FDA, as I mentioned, has a very strict interpretation of a drug. And so what you'll notice in these four bullet points is these are all endpoints that are very commonly looked at with probiotics and even in prebiotics as well. So if you have a study that shows reducing the risk of diarrhea in otherwise healthy kids in daycare centers, that's a drug. If you improve the ability of a drug to cure an infection, that's a drug. If you reduce the risk of developing side effects from antibiotic use, that's a drug. If you help manage symptoms of any disease, that's a drug. And so many of these studies now that really comprise the bulk of the information that's available on probiotics, as far as the FDA is concerned, are drug studies. Sorry. Let me see. Okay. Sorry. Okay, so now I will say that the FDA has a very legitimate concern about delayed medical care. So the use of foods to treat or manage symptoms of a disease can be problematic if by using those foods you will delay getting needed medical care. And that's an important assessment, I think, for the FDA to make. But what about dietary approaches, in other words, the use of foods for conditions that don't present such a risk? And I would include, for example, probiotics and irritable bowel syndrome. There's no good therapy for IBS. Why not make it so that there's foods that can be studied to help manage symptoms of IBS? Probiotics in the prevention of gastrointestinal or respiratory infections in healthy people. Why can't probiotics and prebiotics be evaluated for prevention of disease? In other words, the use of foods to help keep you healthy. But the FDA won't allow that either. Or probiotics, for example, in enhancing vaccine effectiveness, you know, would be another example of one where you're really not looking at safety risk. So we're sort of in a situation where we can't do that. Now, just as by way of an example, and how am I doing on time? Okay, you know, I'm going to go ahead and skip over these, but there are a couple of studies that have been conducted with healthy people looking at endpoints that would clearly be able to, you know, provide some dietary support for certain conditions, which, again, would be considered drugs on the part of the FDA. So, and that's just an unfortunate situation that we're facing right now. But this really does reflect a disconnect between the type of research that's being done on probiotics and what the FDA seems to view within the scope of foods or as foods and dietary supplement uses. Now, when we look at substantiating claims, we have, I like to consider three basic issues that have to be dealt with. One is product definition. One is proper wording of the claim, and I've mentioned that already. And the other is, can you demonstrate a causal relationship between the probiotic or prebiotic and the health effect? And there, you know, it seems very straightforward, but you have to have all of these in order to have a claim appropriately substantiated. So when you look at probiotic claims, what types of things do you typically see? And I will say that all three of these are what would be considered properly worded structure function claims. And in this case, it's, you know, this particular product, Culturelle, restores the natural balance of good bacteria in your digestive tract, helps strengthen the body's natural defenses, reduces colic, improves digestive health, and health and function, and boosts immunity. Those are all examples of the types of claims you might see on probiotics. But I think it's important for the field to realize that regardless of the claim, it must be substantiated. So you can't just say, well, most probiotics seem to do this, so I'm going to just take an unstudied strain, and I'm going to use these same claims for my strain. You can't do that. There are no generic claims that are possible on probiotics, because I think if we can agree on anything in the probiotic field, at least relative to the research progress we've made to date, it's that effects do seem to be strain-specific. So claim substantiation must be based on the specific strain or combination of strains that's used, the dose, and, as was mentioned in multiple times before, earlier today, a bioequivalent matrix, or a matrix that is going to have the same activity, the delivery matrix for the product. So I think that we have to realize in the United States there's no legal definition of the term probiotic, which makes it kind of difficult to enforce the scientific definition. And probiotics really have to be related on intention of use. And they can fall into multiple categories, conventional foods, dietary supplements, not really medical foods, but it is a possible category, and drugs. Now, I think when we look at a hierarchy of evidence, what we really are looking for substantiation of claims is randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. And I think that everyone in the scientific community can agree on that. And there are a variety of hopes that you have with this trial, that you have a population that reflects the target population, you're using an appropriate format and dose that's equivalent to what's being sold, with endpoints that are appropriate for the category. And you're hoping that you have consistency among studies, and that your data are published, and that you then can have an appropriately worded claim that comes out of that. Oftentimes the reality is that you have a might have randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial that has limitations. It's either in a different target population than what you're looking at, it's either in a foreign country, or if it's in adults and you're hoping to make claims that would apply to children, or it's in children and you hope to make claims applying to adults. It's in a different product format or dose, or it might have a disease format. And so these studies really do provide evidence of biological activity, but relative to providing the foundation of primary substantiation to make a claim, they're inadequate. You really have to have a claim that can really be the gold standard evidence that was shown in the previous slide. Now, an example of this, and I don't mean to be using BB12, but it was just a great one to use, is I think what often happens in the field of probiotics is people are amazed at the incredible speed with which the field is progressing. And so so what I tried to do in this slide was to provide an example of what happens when you look at trying to substantiate a specific claim for a specific product. And let's use the example of BB12. And let's just say we want to try to make a support immune function type of a claim for BB12, using it at 10 to the 9th CFU per day. And we want to support that claim in adults, or at least in the general population. Well, when we look at the probiotic literature as a whole, if we subtract out reviews, a PubMed search will show that we have close to 5,000 papers on just probiotics. If you limit that to clinical studies, we're down to about 800 studies. If you look at the studies of those that are only on BB12, we have about 113 studies. If you look at BB12 that are clinical trials, PubMed shows up about 35 of these. If you look at how many of these are focused on immune or mention immune as some type of indicator in it, you're down to 17 studies. But then if you subtract out the studies that were conducted with additional strains or with additional functional ingredients, you're now down to 9 studies. Now if you insist on being able to make your claim at 10 to the 9th, you have to eliminate all studies that were done at doses higher than that. Now we're down to 4 studies, and if you look at how many were done in healthy adults, which is your target population for the product, you're down to 0. So essentially you can start with a series of information that is like seems quite impressive, but when you get to trying to substantiate a specific claim, it gets much more difficult to really find the foundation studies to support the claim. So there are a variety of challenges in doing studies on pro and prebiotics, and I've got many of these listed here. I don't really have the time to go into them in any kind of detail. I will just point out one of them is that in terms of identifying a proper placebo for your study can be really quite challenging. And that's the case for one reason, at least, is that sometimes your placebo can actually be an active product as well. And I think it was mentioned earlier today that, in fact, dairy products themselves may contribute to some of the endpoints or improving functionality within some of the endpoints that we're looking at. So how do you both blind a study and properly placebo control a study? Well, if you need to blind it, you obviously have to be feeding the same matrix that your probiotic is being delivered in, so you need to deliver it in a yogurt. But by doing that, you may then be increasing the function, or you might be adding functionality to your placebo, which means that any effect that your probiotic exerts has to not only have an effect as a probiotic, but it has to be above and beyond what the placebo does as well. And it just can be very challenging to do that. So this slide really was just designed to comment on what has already been commented before, but I think one of the biggest challenges we have facing the probiotic industry right now relative to substantiation of claims is understanding many of the impacts of different environmental issues associated with how probiotics express their functionality, including the production parameters, the product parameters, or the matrix parameters, as well as issues relative to the host, primarily gut microbiota, for example, and how it may impact on expression of functionality of the probiotic. So, in conclusion, how can we navigate probiotic health benefit claims in this what's really turning out to be a fairly complicated regulatory environment? And I would say, first and foremost, we need to stay committed to good basic science. And I say this because when you look at the activities, for example, of EFSA, when you look at FDA and the FTC, really they are ultimately basing their decisions on what scientific experts in the field would agree to be legitimate conclusions. And we may disagree with some of their approaches and may disagree with some of the boxes they put us in. At the end of the day, you need to have good quality science to substantiate your claims. So we need to push for high standards of evidence. We need to acknowledge weaknesses in the data set that we have for substantiating claims and make up for those. We need to craft the wording of the claims carefully so they specifically address what's going on. You know, what they need to specifically reflect what's in the studies. And I also think, and this is personal opinion, we need to consider ways to nudge our regulatory interpretations more favorably toward a recognition of the value of foods in prevention and management, dietary management of disease. And right now, those are just off limits for foods. And I think we need to recognize that progress in understanding of how probiotics function and hopefully the development of biomarkers and the ability to sort out responders versus non-responders is going to be helped tremendously by progress of the Human Microbiome Project. So I'll end there. Thank you.
We touched on some challenges that the new interpretation is putting into search. Of course, another layer of that, an IND investigation, the IRB process is very complicated. I see this being, I think, your idea that you can touch the agency because there could be a chill effect in search that is needed to advance the entire people. So, do you have any thoughts about how? This is a very large organization.
Yep. Repeat the question. I think just in a nutshell, I think what Jeff is saying is it's going to be critical to try to see if we're going to really, I'm going to editorialize a little bit, if we're going to really be able to achieve the true benefits I think the pro and prebiotics can offer, we're going to need to be able to investigate the types of endpoints that are appropriate for them, but what now can we do to try to possibly nudge regulatory interpretation? And you know, what options do we have? And I do think there is the option, for example, of the citizen petition. You can petition the FDA and say, hey, we would like you to consider something. But from what I understand, that's a real laborious type of task to do. I think that we also are probably not going to succeed if we try to change food law. And food and drug are defined in the, you know, the legislative record. So we probably are not going to change that. But I guess my hope is that we could maybe say, let's create a new category of foods. And I know people don't want to create a category of functional foods, but I think that the FDA has already acknowledged that, or I shouldn't say the FDA, Congress has already acknowledged that foods can play a role in reducing the risk of long-term chronic diet-related disease, such as osteoporosis and certain types of cancer. What they haven't been willing to do is to say those types of effects might also be achieved with certain types of acute diseases, such as irritable bowel syndrome or, side effects associated with antibiotics. And I think that, and that's their interpretation. That's an interpretation on their part. That's not written into code, into the law. So, you know, maybe there's a way through interactions with regulatory agencies, and they're keeping an eye on what's going on in Europe as well, and Europe has a different interpretation to some extent. So, you know, I don't know. I think it's going to be a lot of small steps before any changes come. Okay, one more. Yep. Said colic. Mm-hmm. Oh, in terms of the Dannon product where they removed the word immunity, I can't speak to why Dannon made that decision. I really don't know. I just know that it came after the lawsuits were filed and after the FTC started, you know, looking at their claims, and so you can draw a conclusion that it must have been something that was said, but it could have been one of two things. I don't think anyone questioned that term is an appropriate term for structure function claim. I think the question is does it, if it's interpreted by a reasonable consumer in an appropriate way relative to the body of evidence that is supporting that statement. And I think that's probably where, the decision must have been made, because you can refer to the normal functioning of the human body with a structure function claim. So immunity is a normal function of the human body. So that does not turn it into a drug just by saying immunity. Okay, thank you.